Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Beautiful, gut-wrenching stories about things complicated and joyful, devastating and life-changing. That's Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Crave more public radio storytelling? Dig into the Snap Judgment podcast. Find Snap on iTunes along with other NPR podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we plunge into the strange and oddly duplicative world of the sci-fi drama Orphan Black. We take a little time to consider the pop culture dream sequence, and as always, we close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us this week is Petra Mayer.
Yay!
Petra Mayer, what do you do at NPR?
Hi, I am an editor with NPR Books, specializing in all things nerd.
Oh, wonderful. Some of you may recall Petra from a previous podcast that we did about books.
It was so alliterative. You are a pro.
It was alliterative. Very terribly alliterative. So what we did this week, Orphan Black is about to come back on BBC America, and we decided that we would take a look at this show, those of us who have not seen it, and those of us who have seen it, like me, would
get much less homework.
So Orphan Black, if you are not familiar with it, Orphan Black is a drama about, Glenn, how would you give the rundown of Orphan Black to the uninitiated?
I wouldn't tell them too much about it, actually.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, then we're done here.
Yeah.
Topic number two.
I would say that a young woman is on a train track in some unnamed city. It's Toronto. And she sees a person who looks very, very much like her, in fact, her exact double, throw herself in front of a train and kill herself. And she takes her identity, and things develop from there. Hijinks ensue.
I think it may be impossible to discuss this show while telling you as little as you might want to know if you wanted to start it from the beginning knowing nothing. So because this show has been through a full season, it is about to start its second season. So what I think it is fair to say, because it is the premise of the show, mm-hmm. once you get past the stolen identity, it is the premise of the show that this young woman finds that she has been cloned. So the actress, whose name is Tatiana Maslany, plays not just Sarah, the young woman who finds the other one on the train track, but a variety of other, perhaps, versions of herself, the various clones. And in fact, I believe Stephen is only a little more than halfway through the first season. So
okay.
I'm not even going to tell him how many there may eventually be.
All right.
There are 300 million.
Well, there have been
spoilers.
There have certainly been theories at times that maybe there were 26.
That's
and
my
one was going to have every letter of the alphabet.
Absolutely, because
that's her name.
None of the people that we've met on the show so far, Stephen and Petra, their names start with a different letter of the alphabet. Now, that could mean that there's 26 of them, or it could mean that it's going to spell out some kind of code eventually.
Or it could mean nothing.
This is the kind of show that has one of these really elaborate mythologies that I go down a rabbit hole in. This is exactly what I like. This reminds me of the way I felt about Lost in the early seasons when I was like, something is happening. And then, you know, we won't have that conversation again, Linda Holmes, but, you know, it's not going to end up. I get the feeling this is such a hard genre show that we're not going to end up with it being about people's feelings.
Well, now, you made an interesting point just now. You said it's a genre show.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bunch of genres, though.
Absolutely.
It is a conspiracy thriller. It is a serial killer drama. At various points, it turns into Criminal Minds.
Yeah.
You know? And all of a sudden, it's like, this is a really interesting way to do the show Criminal Minds. It's a police procedural. Again, a really interesting way to do a police procedural. I'm now through episode 6. And I'm through the episode in which the soccer mom clone is trying to throw a little party.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns into a madcap...
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, look, they're twins. They're playing each other. You know, and there's a bunch of even kind of wacky mix-ups that occur because of this. It is so many genres, and it shifts from episode to episode, and it shifts within an individual episode.
It's true. Now, when we first started talking about the possibility that we would discuss this show on this week's episode, we were talking about who we wanted to invite to join us for this conversation. And what Glenn said was, I guarantee you... that Petra watches this show. I guarantee you that was his exact phrase. And then I learned he was wrong.
Sorry, Glenn.
Petra had not been watching this show. Now, Petra, you are sort of a sci-fi person, yes? You can't nod at the microphone.
No,
she was nodding. Petra's the radio professional in here.
Yeah, but I'm
nodding.
Very rarely on this side of the microphone, so you got to cut me some slack. I hadn't watched Orphan Black, but I was certainly aware of it because, of course, it comes on after Doctor Who. So I was seeing these ads every week and thinking, oh, that show looks interesting.
Plus,
I should watch it.
I have to assume we're not the first pushy people to want you to watch this show out of your social group.
Actually, no, you are the first people. We're defying conventions left, right, and center here.
You don't have people bugging you to watch
this
show.
You are hanging out with the wrong nerds.
I know. I have people that are bugging me to watch Game of Thrones, but not this show. Not everybody has BBC America.
Yeah, that's true.
Only people like me who love Doctor Who enough to shell out all that money per month.
So how much of it did you watch?
Darn you, Stephen. Watch the whole first season plus the advanced screener.
There you go.
Petra, you're a superhero.
But I wanted to take off on the thing you said about genres, because the thing that kept coming to mind for me was this is a Joss Whedon show. Mm-hmm. You know, all those scenes with Cosima, who's the nerdy science clone, at her computer finding out she ended up kind of being more of a plot device than an actual character, because she was clearly the Willow. She was the one who everybody went to for... generic sciencing.
And, and Beth's waxy-chested boyfriend is Riley. He's totally the Riley.
Which definitely feeds into the thought that I kept having over and over again as I was watching this show, which is that this is what Dollhouse should have been. Mm-hmm. This is Dollhouse with somebody at the center who can actually act.
Now, remind us what Dollhouse was.
Dollhouse was,
in brief.
Right, was Joss Whedon's show... after everything else he had done got canceled. So I think it got
And before Dollhouse got canceled.
I think it got two sympathy seasons. The central premise was a mysterious organization that can implant personalities into essentially sort of mind-wiped meat puppets.
Right.
And Eliza Dushku played the central mind-wiped meat puppet, and every week she had to assume a different personality and take on a different disgustingly... objectified.
Right.
So I was going to say this is sort of, you know, Dollhouse with a better actress at the center of it would have still been a misogynist, creepy piece of creepy misogyny.
Yeah.
It would have been watchable. I mean, I just kept wishing over and over again that Tatiana Maslany would have been the central actress there.
She is killing it.
See, this is the thing. You forget the gimmick of the show. You are watching scenes where she is acting against herself, and you're like, yep, absolutely fine. Yeah. Now, when she goes on award shows, and she's received plenty of awards for this, she always takes time out to mention her stand-in. Actually, she doesn't call her her stand-in. She calls her performance double, the woman who is actually standing in for the role of one of her other clones in scenes like that. And she gives the woman's name is Catherine Alexander, and she gives a lot of credit to her for starting to anticipate, now that they've been working together so long, she is able to anticipate what Tatiana Maslany is going to do.
What her performance will be like when she's in that spot.
Which you have to trust the other person, because I've got to imagine that is a fraught, very fraught relationship.
Yeah, I mean, among other things that I was thinking watching this, one, I thought, this is the juiciest role in the history of juicy roles. You get to play a crazy German. You get to play a lesbian. You get to play, it's all the parts.
And all the accents.
She has accents. And she does
It never occurred to me when I watched the first episode of this show that this actress was not British. It never even occurred to me that she wasn't British. She's not
British. Wait, you mean she's not?
She's Canadian.
Oh.
That is not her accent at all. It never occurred. Because later when she was doing other accents, I was like, oh, she's very good at hiding her British accent. And then I saw her at an awards show and I was like, she's not even British. That's crazy. But I had the same experience. It is a really... insane acting feat that she is engaged in there.
But it's also like every other actor watching that must be so ticked off that they don't get to stretch that much. It is such a juicy part. Also, I mean, the way they handle all the there are multiple Tatiana Maslanis in the frame, I really expected more seeing the backs of heads.
Yeah, right.
You know, I expected much more grody split screen where you can see the seams almost.
Right.
And it is very, very, very effective. And she, not only does she play all these different characters, she often, at least in the six episodes that I have watched so far, she'll play one of those characters impersonating another one of those
characters.
I love
those scenes. Blows my mind. Love those scenes.
And so there are all these, like, she's playing in between one character and another character, and you can tell. She does enough acting in her face that you can tell. I mean, it's really
like
a remarkable performance.
That's not Cosima. That's Sarah pretending to be Cosima.
Right.
And it's a different performance from either of those two. But fundamentally, it's still the Sarah performance because it's still Sarah.
Right.
And I love watching her. And one of the things I love about this show is that I sit there and I watch it for a while and I'm having a great time. And it's a super entertaining show. And then I just sit there and I give myself the little shot of adrenaline that you get when you look at that show and go, that's all the same lady.
And then I just
giggle at it all over again because I do completely forget. And then, you know, Stephen was mentioning there's not a lot of the split screen and back of heads. But, like, they've figured out ways to do it so she can punch herself where you can clearly see both faces. And she can punch herself. She's got herself in headlocks. They've figured out ways to have her stick a gun in her own face. It's crazy what they have figured out how to do on that show. And I'm not going to lie, it is one of the pleasures of that show. You don't want to be sitting there admiring the visual effects. And normally, I think, if you're sitting there admiring the visual effects, something's wrong. But in this case, it is one of the pleasures of that show.
It's certainly the best use of Skype on screen I've ever seen. I mean, every time they would bring up a Skype conversation between her and Cosima, I would think, ooh, that's a smart way of getting them both in the same frame.
Yeah.
I love her body language so much that you mentioned, you've been talking about the way she plays one character playing another, and there's a scene where Alice in the Uptight Soccer Mom has to impersonate Sarah the Hustler, and you can tell that her body language is very stiff, but that she's trying
but
to
she's
imitate
trying
the
to
way
loosen
she
it.
Thinks somebody self-confident and sexy and swaggering would work, and she looks like a disjointed doll. And it just, the physicality of her performance blows my mind.
Yeah, I actually have a favorite character, which is kind of odd to think of because it's all the same person, but Allison is my favorite character.
Oh, mine too.
The Uptight Soccer Mom, because the performance is, there's such fun in it because you can kind of see the actress behind it, but you can't also. And I was thinking about it the other time. Here's something I've never seen on American television. A gun-toting soccer mom and her pal, the gay hustler. Like, I want to see that show.
Yeah. That buddy act is one of my favorite things about the show.
It is really a really strong thing.
And he is also wonderful.
Oh.
Jordan Gavaris, who plays Sarah's friend, Felix.
Sarah's foster brother.
Yes.
Right.
Sorry, yes. Sarah's foster brother, Felix, who is sort of the same way that Allison is really allowed to be funny in this story that's very dark. Felix is also very funny. And kind of both of them, but especially him, he really specializes in those reactions that are sort of like, oh, really? You know, like, oh, somebody else is chasing you. Wonderful.
Yep.
Like,
but one thing that those two characters have in common is they are really allowed to evolve. You know, they are reacting to these situations and being put in new situations where they're forced to be con artists. That, you know, Felix is a little bit more of a con artist than Allison, but, you know, Allison kind of hardens over the course of the series, and he becomes much more kind of protective and resourceful rather than merely just commenting wryly on what's happening around him.
And who would have guessed that they would be friends? You know, that they would strike up this friendship.
So much of the show is the performances, but I mean, the writing's solid. Now, with Allison, you know, every so often, like in that scene that you were talking about, the party scene, you know that there's going to be a book club joke. You know there's going to be a Chardonnay joke. And that's fine. I can live with that. The thing that does kicks me out of all of these sort of massive conspiracy thriller shows, which is where these alliances keep shifting and roiling. And so somebody who has just tried to kill somebody is now, like, these people don't know how to hold grudges sufficiently. if somebody was like, I have the answers you seek, I'd be like, you just tried to kill me. We can only get them if we join forces. You just tried to kill me. I mean, there's a girl in seventh grade who said something unflattering about me physically. And if I see her to this day, there will be glaring. I'm not taking glaring off the table. But you have to kind of run with it. You have to kind of say, okay, fine. And the plot does fall back and forth and flop back and forth a lot, but it's part of the deal.
It's dictated to these people by the desperate circumstances they're in.
Right.
True, but can we at least talk about the character of Paul? because in contrast to Tatiana Maslany, who I want to be when I grow up, Paul is so wooden that you can't tell what side he's on. It makes the ambiguous writing and the shifting alliances even harder to pick apart.
But I think, like Riley on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, who he is so much like, he is there to be a little bit more of a... You know, a little bit more of
plank.
A little bit more plank. Thank you. I was going to say lunk. We were so close. Same
plank.
Brain. And we are clones. And you know, so he's given a lot less to work with.
Yeah, I think it's true. I mean, he begins as the boyfriend of one of the clones, and then winds up entangled with another one. His function, I think, is a little less clear. Not necessarily his plot function is there, but his tonal function is not as clear as almost all of these other people. Because as Stephen was pointing out, you sort of got a clone who's more the horror movie clone.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And the clone who's sort of the farce clone, and the clone who's kind of the badass British girl clone. And then you have, you know, as we said, Felix, who's kind of this interesting comic relief. You have her partner, you have the former partner of one of the cops, one of the clones who was a cop. And he is really doing kind of that procedural side and has very much the tone of a...
He has the knitted brow.
Right. Yeah. He has the knitted brow of a serious cop on a cop show. And I think the purpose of the Paul character... Not just plot wise, but in making the show interesting,
he has
is
to
maybe
take a shirt off.
Is
in
is
those
maybe,
incredibly unbelievable love scenes,
is maybe less clear than it is for almost anyone else. Because even some of the other supporting characters, like Allison's husband, kind of fits into her world,
right.
Has a tonal function, and Paul is really just kind of a plank. I mean, it's sad but true.
Did any of you find in the score of this show, particularly in the first few episodes, they do a sound that goes, ear, and every time they do it...
It's the Helena sound.
Every time they do it, I get the song Toxic by Britney Spears stuck in my head because it is the first half of that, ear. And so I always suddenly... That, you know, Glenn, you talked about being taken out of the show. Every time they did that effect, I was suddenly like, you know that you're toxic.
Given how on the nose some of the song choices are in this show, I love him. I mean, you know, that German version of These Boots Are Made for Walking when she's pretending to be the German rock star. But I could see them picking that for Helena. It threw me out of the show because every time I heard that noise, even if she wasn't on screen, I was like, oh, it's the Helena noise. We're going to see her soon. Mm.
Yeah. We were watching the first episode of the second season, and I was wondering to myself, can somebody who hasn't seen the first season pick it up? Nope.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. No way in hell.
I'm always hesitant to say that because I don't want to make it sound like don't watch the show. It's a really good show. I do recommend you start at the beginning and watch the whole
thing. It's a super, super, super easy show to find. If you have Amazon Prime, it is free on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. If you have Comcast On Demand, the whole first season is on Comcast On Demand. It is not a difficult show to locate if you have the basic ways that people catch
up on
shows.
And my guess is, I can't swear to this, but I'll try to put up a link on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. Because my guess is that BBC America leading up to this will probably marathon that first season at some point. Mm. I'll check and if
they'd
they're
be
doing
wise
that,
to do so.
If they're doing that, we'll try to get that posted. So I mean, I just think it's a show that's very unusual. Of all the shows where they say strong, interesting female characters, many times it does not actually apply. It does apply in this situation. Yeah. This is absolutely her show. One of the things that's amazing is watching this kind of sprawling show with all these pieces, and she's in just about every scene. There are, you know, isolated pieces of connective tissue.
Where a dude talks to another dude portentously.
Where a dude talks to another dude.
Where a dude talks to another dude about her.
Yeah, wait a minute. Does a show pass the Bechdel test if the two women talking to each other are the same woman?
That's true. Well, and does the show pass the backwards Bechdel test if every time two men talk to each other, it's about some version of the same woman?
Oh, no, man.
Anyway, well, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you think of Orphan Black. And if you don't watch it, we will continue to argue that you should. Our other topic today came to us, as many of our topics do, through our Facebook page. And we wanted to talk a little bit today about dream sequences. We're in a very unreal sort of place today. We've got clones. We've got dream sequences. We're sci-fying it up all over the place.
I'm drunk.
And there's a dream sequence in Orphan Black.
There are, sort of. I would assume there are several. Yeah. I don't remember any off the top of my head. Now, Glenn, you, in preparation for this show, wrote up a whole long list of dream sequences for us. Yep. And I was wondering whether you were off somewhere coming up with a taxonomy of dream sequences.
Nope. I mean, it occurred to me that there are dream sequences, there are fantasies, there are prophetic visions, but that took me down to a hole.
So in other words, yes.
No, what I'm thinking is, for me, it occurred to me that a lot of the dream sequences I thought of are pretty old.
Yeah.
And it seems like this is a narrative crutch that people aren't really taking advantage of as much as they used to. And certainly, you just have to look at any episode of The Simpsons where there's a dream sequence to know that the dream sequence has been around for so long that it already has all of these cliches attached to it, because
right.
That's what The Simpsons are doing, is making fun of those cliches. I think I respond better to dream sequences when they do some emotional work as opposed to narrative work. Mm-hmm. So there is a taxonomy. There's a taxonomy right there. Just had to dig a little bit.
I know it.
Emotionally, like, what dreams do is your brain puts everything that makes you feel a certain way in the same sort of box. And dreams kind of run you through those things. So the logic of dreams isn't intellectual logic, it's emotional logic. So it's like, oh, my teeth are falling out, I gotta take a test, I'm naked. Like, all that is all part of the same piece. All this stuff you feel shame about.
I call that Tuesday.
So somebody who can do that, who can kind of connect things emotionally, is David Lynch. Just about every film that David Lynch does has some either surreal dream sequence or something. But surreal isn't just throwing a bunch of crazy crap at you. There's an internal, as I say, emotional logic. And when I come across a dream sequence that is about, oh, this is going to tell us what's happening in the next scene, or this is... All I want from a dream sequence is, what is the character feeling? What do they think?
Because Glenn's all about emotion.
I'm all about the feelings. And as soon as it starts to, like, for example, in Twin Peaks, the first time we see the man from another place, the Red Room, it's a dream. As the series progresses, more mythology attaches to that. It becomes more of a place, another location, and all of its mystical power, all of its real power to have an emotional punch kind of gets bled away. I think that's just the nature of it. Emotion's not narrative. That's my thing.
I think that I'm sure we could come up with all sorts of taxonomies of dream sequences, but I definitely think you can come up with a taxonomy of purposes for dream sequences. You have the complete red herring. You have the kind of, what? It was all a dream.
Yeah.
You know, where it looks like something terrible has happened and then all of a sudden, bluck, the person wakes up. You also have, you know, the dream sequence as fantasy. You know, like you said, emotions. You know, what does the person want? And also the way I think I see them used most nowadays is very brief ways to mete out little bits of backstory. Especially in these very, very convoluted stories. I mean, we talked a little bit about Captain America within the last couple of weeks, and I was talking about how the mystery is what the hell is going on. And, you know, that's true of Orphan Black. It's true of a lot of these very complicated, convoluted stories, and dream sequences are nice ways to sort of stir up the pot and create confusion while still slipping you a little bit of information. I mean, you have, I don't know if I would exactly call it a dream sequence, but in Orphan Black, she is visualizing like medical experiments being performed on her, and that's giving you a little bit of a sense that there's more, you know, there are yet more people pulling strings.
Right. I think like Glenn said, you have your dreams, you have your daydreams, you have your visions, you have your
prophecies.
Flashes of memory, your prophecies. What say you, Petra?
I was going to follow on from what Stephen was talking about in fantasy, which is, you know, I read a lot of fantasy. I'm a tragic nerd. Dreams are almost always plot advance tools.
Right.
You know, they're not... They're Jungian rather than Freudian. Their message is to the dreamer, not about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're there to give you some cryptic information about what's going to happen in the next chapter. And one of my favorite fantasy satires is a book by Diana Wynne Jones, and it's called The Tough Guide to Fantasyland, and it's basically a parody tour guide. In the paragraph about dreams, she says, "Dreams. While you are on tour, your psyche is in the care of the management, who will, when necessary, provide you with dreams. You should always attend to these, particularly when they are repeated in the next night in the same form. They occupy the same slot as legends. They will be telling you something you need to know for the next phase of your tour, but they will not be doing so very clearly. You will need to think of it."
I like that description. I mean, I know it's satirical, but I like that description.
Well, that's why that book is so great. It's satirical, but it cuts right to the heart of what's actually going on.
Yeah, and one of the things that always surprises me about dream sequences is that more of them are not better at... considering that there's, if it's cinematic and you have so many opportunities to capture that kind of weird randomness of dreams and that internal but not really logical logic that Glenn was talking about, how rare it is for them to really be right, and how often they're very lazy to me when they are linear,
right,
in a way that's completely dishonest. That right. Somebody has a dream where they wake up, they go to school, they have banter with their family, just like always, and then they go off and something happens, blah, blah, blah. And in fact, if you think about it, every A Christmas Carol, you know, mm-hmm. is sort of like this.
Absolutely.
Sure.
It's much more true, and it always just feels intuitively more true to me when you have the ones where they have that sense of dreams where, for example, there's one in My So-Called Life when Angela Chase is talking about she has a dream where she's in the hallway at school, but she's also at a funeral. And the funeral is kind of going on in part of the hallway at school. And people are there who shouldn't be there. And she doesn't. It's all she's sort of saying, like, it was this place, but it was also this place. Yeah. And everybody knows that experience of having dreams where you say, well, it was my bedroom, but it was also school.
Yep. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you in the dream, you knew that. And in the dream, it made perfect sense. And it's funny to me that it's so rare for cinematic dreams to get that feeling of...
Well, the constantly shifting sense of place.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
I think there's an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer does that particularly well, where they're kind of rambling from room to room, almost as if they're going through tunnels. I would also throw out Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind,
sure,
which has a lot of, you know, places kind of springing up and collapsing in ways that are, you know, ways that are really beautiful. I mean, it's funny, like, what you said about dream sequences, Linda, it kind of reminds me of what I sometimes say about shows or movies or whatever, where you can read people's thoughts. And they always think in complete sentences.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I just think, am I unusual in that I'm just, it's just fragments of words and false starts. And if you actually were to read my thoughts, first of all, it's just chaos up here. Second of all, it's very, you know, it's very often kind of almost like research. It's almost like researching the speech that
right.
I'm about to give.
Right.
It's not any kind of linear thing. And I think... I'm sure, you know, because it's easier to present a linear picture, visually speaking, is one reason you don't get that as much. And just the way that if you actually were to survey the hash that is somebody's thoughts, you wouldn't, you know,
right.
you wouldn't be able to follow it as well.
The Buffy episode Restless is the one you're talking about that has the dreams where that sense of place keeps changing. The brilliant thing about that is they just used the set. The sets are kind of on top of each other, so somebody could go through a door in one set and enter another set, and that all they did was film it, because that's the way dreams work. And the other thing that's brilliant about that particular episode is that there's a blankness of affect of people. We see something happening that should provoke an emotional response, and it doesn't, because the thing that makes it creepy and dreamlike is that there's this distance between the stimulus and the response. Mm. So Anya is sort of detached in a way that we don't normally associate with that character. That's why I thought it was a particularly good example of that.
And all this deep analysis of dreams and their place in pop culture, I don't want us to forget the fact that sometimes dream sequences are there just because they're cool.
Uh-huh. Right.
I mean, you're talking about the history of dream sequences and the way that they can shift locales, and I want to throw a shout out to my celluloid boyfriend Buster Keaton, mm-hmm. who was the master of the dream sequence. You know,
that's kind of a hopeless crush.
Yeah.
Well, a girl can dream, can't she?
It may not work out.
Look, if the TARDIS ever does come for me, you know where I'm going. All right, that's all I'm going to say. The Italian mansion, Hollywood, 1921. I'm there. Anyways, but God, now you got me all flustered thinking about Buster Keaton. I guess I'm just weird. But he has two films. One is called The Playhouse, and one is called Sherlock Jr. Of those two, probably Sherlock Jr. is the one that most people know, because it's the one where he's a theater projectionist, and he falls asleep. And Dream Buster gets up in sort of ghostly image and walks down the aisle and jumps up into the movie screen. And as he's there, he enters the movie, and the scenery keeps shifting around him, which in 1924 was quite revolutionary. He didn't realize, you know, he didn't reveal for years that they had done this with surveyor's instruments, just sort of minutely analyzing his pose as the scene shifts from, you know, a park with a lion to a snowdrift to a beach where he dives into the water but lands in a sand dune, I think. And really the only reason that's there is because it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And they are used. One of the things that I was thinking about when Glenn was mentioning that a lot of the examples that he had come up with were pretty old, I was thinking about the fact that I think, like what Petra was just saying, I think dream sequences used to be used as a way to do things that were experimental while still being able to say that you hadn't really broken the rules of narrative storytelling.
Right.
So, for example, you know, that's how you can have Dorothy go to Oz and the witch and all of that and still say, like, no, 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 it's not really a fantasy movie. It's still in reality. It's just a dream because, you know, anything can happen in a dream. And you would have, you know, sometimes dream sequences, I think, were used just so that you could do something or try something that was different than what you could do. If you look at, you know, some of the musicals of the 40s and 50s had dream sequences.
Right.
You Oklahoma.
Know, some of them didn't, but some of them did. Oklahoma has an extended dream ballet that's really there because it's a way to incorporate a huge ballet in the middle of a Broadway musical, which people would not have tolerated because it doesn't seem, for one thing, at least, I don't know for sure whether this was always done on stage, but at least in the movie, you have to swap in dancers for you know, your Shirley Jones and your Gordon McRae, who cannot do a dream ballet. So you kind of have to have that sense of unreality if you're going to turn the ballet over to ballet dancers. And then it sort of makes sense because if you're having a dream, someone who's not quite you, but they kind of represent you, it makes a little more quote unquote sense.
Right.
There's the dream sequence, the ballet in An American in Paris is really a dream sequence. It's at least a daydream sequence. And that, again, is an opportunity to incorporate this dance sequence that otherwise you wouldn't really be able to say you were still doing kind of realistic, semi-realistic, the romantic sense of realistic filmmaking.
Right.
So I think sometimes it was used in this experimental way. But I think now, if you want a break and just put a musical number in the middle of your movie, even if it were a ballet, you might just do that
and
not say it's a dream. You might just make your movie where Dorothy goes to Oz. I think there's less need for those dream sequences because there's less need to explain the rules that you're breaking.
Right. The Hitchcock film Spellbound has one of the most famous dream sequences in history. It's designed by Salvador Dali, and it's, you know, a lot of crazy crap happens, but it's in the middle of this film, this Hitchcock film, which has a very literal, a punishingly literal understanding of psychology, Freudian psychology. So it's like they don't mesh, they don't come together. And the thing that people remember in the film is the dream sequence, not necessarily the plot.
Yeah.
Going back to what Linda just said, okay, this example's kind of old also, but it's, I think, a way for a show to experiment with some kind of major move that the audience might not like, you know, was it Bobby or J.R.?
Well, right. And they on Dallas, it was
J.R.
Well, shooting J.R., but the shooting
right.
A dream.
On Dallas, the dream was used in that case. And this is kind of, if you're going to set up a taxonomy of dream sequences, one way is they just use them to get themselves out of corners.
Exactly. Right.
And that's all that was. In Dallas, when they said, hey, you know, Bobby was dead, but now he got out of the shower because now he's alive because the actor wanted to come back. And it became, and that really was the moment that kind of broke the dream sequence, I think, for a lot of people and put them in a position where anytime you say dream, people feel more betrayed.
Yeah,
than
like it's a cop out. They jump to it being a cop out.
They jump to it being a cop out where it used to be more of a device that people would let you play with a little more. There were a number of kind of these will they or won't they romantic comedy types of shows where you would get a kiss, but it would be a dream. And so you kind of have it both ways. You get to see the people kissing, but it's not really happening because they're still playing around with it. And people didn't used to be, I don't think, quite so embittered about that. And then I think once the Dallas thing happened and they wiped out a whole season of that show and kind of said, reset.
Yeah.
Then everybody went to that place of, boy, if this turns out to be a dream, you know, like that was always on the table in Lost in the discussions when people were really ticked off about Lost. One of the things that was always on the table was if this turns out to be a dream, I'm going to lose it.
Yeah, well, if you've taught freshman comp, if you've ever taught any kind of freshman creative writing class, you were just waiting for the it was all a dream thing at the end. It's something that they rely upon.
Do they really do it?
They still do it.
Wow.
It's crazy.
Well, again, come and find us. Find us on social media. Find us on the blog. Tell us what you think about dream sequences and what is your favorite. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, first, gorging on Orphan Black, even though I am the one person here who did not... I mean, I hadn't already seen 10 of them like Linda had. But that is a really, really fun and great show. And it spiced up my whole weekend as I kind of glommed onto it. We've mentioned our Facebook page a couple times. We have just surpassed 25,000 friends on Facebook. Thanks to everybody for doing that. Finally, I believe it was last week, Linda, you mentioned Tom Lehrer. Mm-hmm. And the kind of ongoing rediscovery of this guy who made 37 songs and then just went on to teach math and left his career behind. There's a wonderful kind of long read piece on him in BuzzFeed that ran last week by Ben Smith on April 9th called Looking for Tom Lehrer, Comedy's Mysterious Genius. And it made me incredibly, we've talked a little bit on this show before about being fans of Lehrer's work. And it was incredibly gratifying to see a place like BuzzFeed just dig super deeply into this very, very finite body of work and sort of what it meant to walk away from it. Ben Smith, through the whole piece, is sort of puzzled by, like, why wouldn't you go on tour? Why wouldn't you, why wouldn't you agree? It was clearly, like, why wouldn't he agree to be interviewed by me? I love the notion of somebody like Tom Lehrer who just feels absolutely no obligation to advance his career the way people want him to advance his career. And I'm actually one of the few people who has gotten to interview Tom Lehrer. Mm-hmm.
Can I touch you?
He was promoting a box set that came out like 10 or 12 years ago. And he liked The Onion when I was working at The Onion. He just had this wonderful, this very lucid way of pursuing not being part of that world.
It's a wonderful interview. And I really liked the BuzzFeed piece. I have to say my reaction to the BuzzFeed piece was mostly to say to people, if you like the BuzzFeed piece, which is all about why he doesn't talk about things, go read the AV Club interview where he talks about them at great length in some detail. That interview is still online. We will link to it. It's a wonderful interview.
I can't say that my own interview with Tom Lehrer is
I can, partly because my two favorite things about this, I mean, obviously, the really important thing about the Tom Lehrer interview is it's great and he talks about wonderful things and he's very interesting. Two small things. He quotes UHF.
Yep.
And then he says to Stephen, I don't know if you know that movie. And it says, the little interview says, The Onion, I do know that movie. Uh-huh. And the other one is that he says he's watching Sports Night. which absolutely killed me. But yes, I agree. I liked the BuzzFeed piece, but I like your interview better.
It does kind of present him as a little bit of a curmudgeonly hermit. And he was lovely and warm.
That's
and
what I
actually
mean.
And wrote me this... I have this letter framed, this lovely letter. Love him, Tom Lehrer.
Read them both. Read them both.
Yep.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Well, Linda Holmes, this time of year, the faithful of many creeds come together to enact and observe the sacred teachings of their faith. Mm-hmm. And gay dudes get drunk and watch Jesus Christ Superstar and go, damn, Kaya Fass is hot. Holy crap, that guy. Even with a hat on his head that looks like a big onion. Still. So he's got this one part where he goes, we need a more permanent solution to our problem. And you're like, whoa, I felt that in my nethers. It reminded me that I talked on the show a little bit about how in college I and my roommate came up with a all-Muppet version of Jesus Christ Superstar. We called it, as you would, Jesus Christ Super Frog. And we honed it. We kept tweaking the cast list. And at one point, I sent that to Jim Henson, saying, look, Jimmy, Bubby, I understand there's some legal issues.
Yeah.
But you have to understand this would be so awesome.
Yes, right?
Nothing. Heard nothing back. So that dream died, as many youthful dreams do. But once a year, I would just think about it and get this pang of loss. Well, Linda Holmes, you and I live in an age of wonders. Nick Fountain hit me one time.
mind is clearer now. At last, all too well, I can see where we all soon will be.
I can't unhear this. I can't.
The myth from the fog, you will see where we all soon will be.
All right. That.
What the?
That. Linda Holmes is Muppet Christ Superstar by a Canadian performer by the name of Christo Graham, like the cracker. I don't think any relation, however. It's up on his Bandcamp website. Now, I am not a Canadian intellectual property attorney. So I don't know what the rules are in terms of fair use and satire and parody. But we'll include a link to this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have issues with his casting choices.
I bet you do.
I mean, I don't think you make Pepe the Shrimp Pontius Pilate. I don't think that makes any sense. When you have a Muppet character, the Pontius Pilate song ends with him counting the lashes that go on the back of Christ. And you have a character whose whole thing is counting. you can interrupt it with like three lashes. You could do that. You're just leaving money on the table. But it's very funny. It's very good. Please go quick like a bunny and download this. Pay him to download it, but you can listen to it for free. Muppet Christ Superstar, which I think is empirically a not as good a title as Jesus Christ Superfrog, but we'll let him go.
Now, was it in any way? You've talked about this publicly. Is this just a coincidence?
Oh, great ideas, Stephen.
No, I understand. No, I understand that there's a finite number.
But you're confident this wasn't lifted from you.
Absolutely, and I wouldn't care if it was. I do not think it was. I think it's just one of these ideas that was waiting. The universe has been waiting for this day. Muppet Christ Superstar.
Wow.
It's so good.
Wow.
Bless his heart.
It's amazing. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. I need to mop my brow. Petra Mayer, what is making you happy this week?
I can't follow that.
No, who can?
No, you know.
You're like Triscuits.
He's just plundered my childhood and burned it to the ground. Yay. There's nothing I can do. Okay. I think the only thing that is a proper response to this would be some squeaking baby sloths. I mean, I have no words, so I'll just let the sloths speak for me. It's a video of baby sloths, and they squeak.
Are they being struck to make that noise?
No, they're bimbling adorably about grassy lawns and peeping out of baskets and climbing up stumps.
Somewhere Trey Graham is hovering in the heavens like Mufasa. And he approves of your choice.
It's like you never left.
And then
they're not being squeezed.
No.
They're not being hit with mallets.
They're doing their own happy little baby squeaky sloth thing.
It's not whack-a-sloth.
Oh, God. You're terrible people. You are all terrible people. And on the non-sloth front, the other thing that's making me very happy this week is they just announced that this fall, Sid Meier's Civilization Beyond Earth is coming out, and if any of you are familiar with the unholy time suck that is the Civilization series, uh-huh. I have wasted years of my life, probably developed circulatory issues from sitting hunched at my desk, tapping out, you know, endless Civilization games. And I'm also probably the only person in this room who's painstakingly nursed along a dying 10-year-old iMac just so that I can play Alpha Centauri, because it requires System 9, and you can't get System 9 anymore. So this makes me happy deep in my nerd parts.
Aw, that's wonderful, Petra.
AKA your brain.
That's wonderful, Petra. Thank you. Well, what is making me happy this week? I sat down last weekend to watch a film with Kristen Wiig playing a very un-Kristen Wiig-like character in a movie called Hate Ship, Love Ship, in which she plays a woman who is subjected to a very nasty trick that sort of fools her into going off to meet this man who she thinks she has been having a long-distance courtship with, but who, in fact, does not know about it. The movie is based on a short story by Alice Munro, Nobel Prize winner, mm-hmm. Alice Munro.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first story in one of her short story collections. And What really made me happy about it, the movie is, I would say, an okay movie. The movie is not a wonderful movie. I wrote a blog post about this. The story has a big piece of it that's kind of cut out, where you follow the story for a while and then you find out what happened much later, or what had happened by much later. And the fact that this sort of gaping hole is left in the story is part of what gives the story some heft. And if you read it, you'll know what I mean. But it was really fun to see, I felt, an adaptation of something so kind of literary. And I thought it was cool that they tried to take something really thoughtful and arty and make it into a movie. And it made me think that I wish they adapted more short stories and fewer novels. And obviously, a certain number of short stories are adapted. Another short story in that same collection was the basis of Away From Her, which Sarah Polley directed. But they don't do that as much as I wish they did. Because when you adapt a short story, you can actually tell the whole thing, if not add stuff.
Yep.
Whereas in a novel, you always wind up taking stuff out. So what made me happy about it was, because I am not a big fiction reader, unfortunately, I read all day, but I don't read a lot of fiction. And because I'm not a big fiction reader, I haven't had that experience too many times of kind of taking the book or the story and taking the movie and kind of really being able to kind of fit them together and think about, like, what do you think of the way that they adapted that, the one from the other? When you're not talking about something like The Hunger Games, where it's like a big book that you have a pre-existing opinion of, it was fun to kind of take a story I didn't really know and a movie I didn't really know and basically take them in at the same time and then think about how that process of adaptation worked. As I said, it's not a great movie. I think it's a good movie. Kristen Wiig is very interesting in it. She's very, very different in it if you're used to only seeing her be manic, which many of us are. So Hate Ship, Love Ship is the movie. And the story is called, like, Hate Ship, Courtship, Friendship, Love Ship, Marriage, or something like that. I might have those out of order, but that's essentially what it is. It does start with Hate Ship. So that is an Alice Munro story. And I recommend especially that you read the story, and also that you consider, if you are a Kristen Wiig person, seeing her spread her wings a little bit in a different kind of role. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Petra. You're a Petramatic, right?
I am.
P-E-T-R-A-M-A-T-I-C. Petra. You can follow our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. That's Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. You can follow our also producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y. And you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Beautiful, gut-wrenching stories about things complicated and joyful, devastating and life-changing. That's Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Crave more public radio storytelling? Dig into the Snap Judgment podcast. Find Snap on iTunes along with other NPR podcasts.